This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
Can you tell instantly when you taste one of those wines that something's been added?
No, and I would argue that very few people actually can. I think it's certainly rational and legitimate to apply that for your own criteria. Maybe you are a big fan of organic agriculture, so you only want to buy wines made from organic grapes. That's great. But to say that only organic grapes can make great wines, well, blind tastings prove that's not the case.
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world, we bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
This is the week where Wine Spectator magazine releases their top 100 wines, and you may know that over the past week or so, they day by day released the top 10 wines, but today the entire list is out. And without saying much more, I want to jump right in with the executive editor out of the New York office, Thomas Matthews. And Tom, you are on the tasting panel, right?
Yes, I am. And a fine place it is.
Yeah, I guess it's probably one of the best places to be. How many people in total are on that panel?
Well, we have 10 tasters. Each one is responsible for specific regions, so that every region is tasted really only by one person. For example, all the Napa Cabernets are reviewed by James Lauby. All the Champagnes are reviewed by Allison Napius. And their initials follow their reviews, so you can sort of find out whose taste agree with yours and then hopefully find them helpful.
So how do the wines end up going into the final ranking? Because, you know, obviously with different people tasting different wines, is it solely based on score?
No, not at all. And I thank you for asking because it's a little bit complicated. We use four criteria to decide which of the 18,000 wines we reviewed this year, all in blind tastings, wind up in a short list of 100.
18,000 wines!
That's right.
How many is that per person?
Well, different people do different amounts. Some of our heavy tasters, like James Molesworth, do almost 4,000. As executive editor, I have other responsibilities, but I do my best with Spain, and I'm almost at 1,000.
Almost at 1,000. Wow. And that tasting begins when and ends when?
This top 100 is drawn from the calendar year issues. So every wine that was published in an issue with a 2014 date was eligible for inclusion.
I see. Okay, so let's get back to the criteria for a second. You said there are four.
The most important one is quality, and that is represented by the score. Nothing below 90 points would ever make the list. But we also take value into concern. We know that, you know, people have to make choices with their dollars, and so wines that are low price for high quality get higher preference. Also, we look at availability. We think that it's more difficult to make big quantities of great wine than small quantities, and so those wines that do manage to make thousands of cases as opposed to hundreds also get an advantage. And the final criteria is something we call the X factor. That's the subjective element of how exciting a wine was. Did it represent a breakthrough for a producer? Did it represent a key vintage for a region? Is it a new type of wine that would get excited for our readers?
It's a wow factor.
Yes, exactly. We sort of try to put all those things together, and the selection process really happens in two phases. For the wine of the year in the top 10, we involve all the editors. We bring all 10 of the tasters to New York for a double-blind tasting of the 15 or 20 serious candidates for those top 10 slots. And after we do the tasting, we unveil the wines. There's a big discussion. Sometimes there's fist fights as people try to get their own wines or some wine that particularly impressed them in the tasting into the top 10. And finally, we come to a consensus, and that will be the 10. And then the other 90, Bruce Sanderson, who's our tasting director, and I pretty much put together with input from the other editors.
So that top 10, is this a situation where you all go into a room and nobody gets to go out until the top 10 are chosen?
Exactly.
How long a period of time does that take?
Well, it always takes a full day, and sometimes it takes 2 or 3 days to really settle on the list. Ultimately, of course, Marvin Shankin, the editor and publisher and owner of Wine Spectator, has the biggest vote. But normally we can come to a consensus, and that's an exciting thing for us.
So let's talk about some of the criteria in a little bit more detail, because I found it very interesting that you actually favor those wines that are able to recreate the quality in a large quantity. I think that's a great thing, because so many of the wines that are made in small quantity, they may be great, but they're out of reach for the vast majority of the population.
Exactly. And also some of the great wines are very high priced, and those get eliminated too. So this is not a score-driven list. This is a balanced list, and in fact, for this year's top 100, the average score is 93 and the average price is $47.
That astounded me at $47. That is very manageable for most people.
And in fact, a full third of the list, 33 wines, cost $20 or less.
$20 or less.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me what's happening in that $20 or less category, because we're seeing that at a lot of wine competitions now. It doesn't necessarily cost a lot of money to get a great wine. Are you always surprised when you find out that the price of something that you loved was a lot less expensive than maybe your perception of it was?
Surprised and happy. And really, that's one of the great virtues of blind tasting. Since we don't know the producer or the price when we're reviewing the wine, even the less expensive wines get a fair shot at an equal rating.
We've talked about this quite a bit on the show, the idea that more people, not just wine judges, should be doing blind tasting. And I've gotten into the habit where whenever I have a dinner party or I go to one, we insist on everything being brown bagged.
I think that's a great idea. People love that.
It's fun to really watch people who consider themselves to be wine aficionados or experts, or, you know, they may be sommeliers, they may be winemakers. And it always astounds me how much we sometimes struggle over actually putting our finger on exactly what that wine is. Do you have that same issue?
Completely. And there's so many scientific studies showing how influential external knowledge like producer's reputation or high price is in our judgments. It's so important to eliminate those factors and just react to the wine in the glass.
We're talking to Thomas Matthews. He's the executive editor of Wine Spectator out of the New York office. Your tasting beat is Spain, also New York?
Yes, New York, Long Island. James Molesworth has claimed the Finger Lakes as his own.
Let's talk a little bit more about price for a second. What do you think is driving the prices down on quality wine, or is something just driving the quality of wine up?
Well, I think both factors come into play. First of all, with more and more wines being produced around the world, there's intense competition for consumers' dollars. So that does keep a lid on prices. And also with increased technology and better farming techniques, better wines can be made for less production costs.
A lot of the high production wines do have a bit of tinkering that goes on with the formulation of those wines. Can you tell instantly when you taste one of those wines that something's been added?
No, and I would argue that very few people actually can. I think it's certainly rational and legitimate to apply that for your own criteria. Maybe you are a big fan of organic agriculture, so you only want to buy wines made from organic grapes. That's great. But to say that only organic grapes can make great wines, well, blind tastings prove that's not the case.
Let's get into the list a little bit now. Have you had a chance to really crunch the top 100 and kind of sort it out by region or varietal or price? Well, certainly you did price. What can you tell us about it in general?
Yes, we always publish those kind of stats in the issue as we publish the list. And this year we had 17 countries represented in the top 100.
Is that more than normal?
It has grown over the years. In the very early years, it was basically just France, California, and Italy. And over the years, it has grown. This year includes Hungary, Israel, South Africa. But the leaders are still the big three. California has 19 wines. Italy also has 19. And France comes just behind with 14.
So where has the shift been?
Well, I think there have been some difficult vintages. For example, most of the wines we tasted from France this year were from 11 and 12, and those were both tough in France. But they were great in Portugal, was the 11 vintage, and that was their best vintage in a generation. And so as a result, there are three Portuguese wines in the top 10.
Wow. And Portugal coming on strong, and Spain is your beat, and Spain is really coming on strong the past years, right?
In fact, last year was the first ever wine of the year from Spain, the Cune Imperial Gran Reserva 2004. So that was a breakthrough for them. This year they have 8 wines on the list.
What's happening in Spain that's driving the quality up?
I think it's the intense talent and energy of the vintners. I mean, they have started exploring ever more obscure regions, ever more obscure indigenous grapes, and really making beautiful wines from them.
So when you look at the sheer quantity of wines that are being made throughout the world right now, it would almost seem like talent would have to be spread pretty thin at this point in time. Or are we just bringing so many good, talented people through the educational system and through internship programs that there's plenty enough to go around and that we can continue to make great quality wines?
I would say that's definitely the case. The wine industry has become so much more attractive to such a broad range of people, both owners coming in from other fields, rich people that want to get a vineyard on their belt, and young people who are interested in the science and the craft and the lifestyle of wine. So Wine Spectator supports, for example, the University of California Davis Enology School through scholarships. And I went out there in June to speak with the students, and they are a very impressive crew. And we've also just made a $3 million donation to Sonoma State University for their wine business program. I mean, that's another thing that which is growing. Wine has grown every year in America for the last 20 years. We're a wine-drinking country now.
We're talking to Thomas Matthews, executive editor of Wine Spectator magazine. And Tom, if you could just hang on for just a second, I'd like to continue this conversation and get into that top 10.
My pleasure.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night.
Giving you permission to do things with wine that you never dreamed of. This is Grape Encounters Radio.
There's only so much wine you can drink.
And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
With Grape Encounters Radio, and so pleased to have on Thomas Matthews, executive editor of Wine Spectator magazine. Tom is one of the panel members that chose the top 100 wines. And Tom, I'd like to talk about that top 10 list.
All right. Well, I think one place to start is with diversity. You've got France, Chile, California, Italy, Australia, and Portugal in the top 10. What amazing wine world we live in.
It's kind of interesting that when you go through the regions, we list them by country and then we say California as though it was its own country.
Well, since it makes 70% of the wine in America, I think it qualifies.
I think so, yeah. All right, tell me the surprises on the list.
Well, I think most people that love Bordeaux are not surprised to see Léa Villescaz at number 10 from Saint-Julien, the second growth, great winery, great tradition. But the 2011 was very tough for Bordeaux, and this was the standout of the year. At number 9, Conchi Toro's Don Melchor is one of the benchmarks for the country. They've been on the list before. That shows that a new world country can make really classic wines. I think one of the surprises would be number 8.
Yes.
From California, the brewer Clifton Pinot Noir, Santa Rita Hills 2012. 2012 looks to be a beautiful year from Pinot Noir in California, and at 94 points and only $40, this is a real beauty.
Are you amazed by the quality of wine that comes out of the Santa Rita Hills?
It has just emerged as one of the top sources for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in California.
Yeah, yeah. And there's been a lot of effort to try to expand that AVA.
Well, you probably know more about that than I do, but dramatically expanding AVAs is rarely a good long-term solution. I think another noteworthy thing about the Brewer Clifton, sometimes Wine Spectator is identified with a certain kind of palate for big, ripe, powerful wines. And we do like that. But we are definitely broad-minded, and we look for quality in every style. And I think the Brewer Clifton is a very different style from that caricatured California style, and they are making terrific wines.
Let's talk about the power of Pinot for a second. I think that's the only Pinot that's on the list. We saw such a surge in Pinot sales and production. Is that starting to wane a little bit now?
No, I don't think so.
Not at all, huh?
In fact, I would say that now great Pinots are coming from New Zealand and starting to come from Chile, and we're seeing them from other regions. Oregon, you know, is really rising too. So I think that trend is still increasing.
Though people, I think, are becoming more daring in terms of other varietals that they hadn't tried before that they seem to be warming up to.
Yeah, look at our number 15 wine, Bedrock, from Sonoma Valley, their heritage bottling from Morgan Twain Peterson. That's Zinfandel, Carignan, and 20 other grapes in that blend.
How do you decide on that formula?
I think he just harvests the vineyard, and everything that's planted goes in the vat.
And it works. Okay, yeah. We're down to number 7.
So now we move to France with Clos des Papes, Châteauneuf-du-Pape. This is another perennial on our list, and one reason is because they don't split their harvest into a lot of different micro-cuvées. They make one big blend, and it's still fantastic. And so that has the availability we're talking about.
All right, and coming in at number 6 from Italy.
Here's another example of a throwback style, Castello di Ama, Chianti Classico, San Lorenzo, Gran Selezione 2010, 95 points, only $52. Italy has moved into the Super Tuscan world, where they're doing a lot of Cabernet, a lot of blends. And Castello di Alma has resolutely stuck with Sangiovese in a kind of classic style, very elegant and focused. And this is a beautiful wine.
Okay. And now we're down to the top five.
Lewin Chardonnay Margaret River Art Series 2011, 96 points, $89. Lewin has one of the benchmark Chardonnays in Australia, but this year represents a stylistic departure for them. They have been sort of in that big, bold, fruit-forward Aussie style, and this one ratchets back and becomes a little more Chablis-like. And so part of the reason it's on the top 10 is because we applaud that shift and we applaud his courage in changing his style.
Okay, so now as we get into the last four, it gets very interesting because three of the last four are from Portugal.
Well, number four and number three are both table wines from the Douro. Number four, Quinta do Vale Meão, Douro 2011, $97.76. And Prats and Symington, Douro Crescia 2011, $97.55 at number three. In the tasting, these wines were basically neck and neck. They both are beautiful, wild expressions of fruit and minerality and mountain herbs. So distinctive and so approachable, even young, that we really could hardly decide between them, so we just put them neck and neck.
Those are interchangeable.
Practically, and I hope people will have the chance to try them both.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to do. All right. Yeah. And our final two.
Number two, Molly Duker, Shiraz McLaren Vale Carnival of Love 2012, $95.75. This is your in-your-face Aussie Shiraz. I mean, there's no apologies for the 15-plus alcohol, for the big, chewy fruit, for the lots of American oak. Some people say that style's over. We don't believe it for a minute. This is a beautifully rendered wine. And again, they are quite familiar with our top 10, Molly Duker.
All right, and we're down to number one.
Number one was the Dow's Vintage Port 2011, 99 points, $82, 5,000 cases made. 2011 was really a benchmark and landmark vintage for port, probably the best one since 1994 and maybe back to 1927.
Now, you've been with Wine Spectator since 88, and I think this list started the year that you came on full-time, right?
That's right.
How many times has a port been in first place?
This is the second time. The last time was in 1997 with two 1994 vintage ports, Taylor's and Fonseca. Although it had stiff competition, of the 40 2011 vintage ports we tasted, 25 earned classic ratings of 95 points or higher. You really cannot go wrong buying port in this vintage.
Yeah. Hey, Thomas, I really appreciate you going through this with us. The entire list is on the website. Costs nothing to go online, but you should really subscribe to Wine Spectator. It's a great magazine. It really is the benchmark in the wine industry, but all 100 are there when, you know, there are so many wines out there and I get asked so many times, what should I drink? This is a great way to decide what you should drink. The entire list is at winespectator.com. Thomas Matthews, I really appreciate you being on with us.
A great pleasure. Thanks for the time.
Thank you too. And we'll be back with more Grape Encounters Radio right after this.
Grape Encounters is 100% estate-grown. We have, however, removed the pretentiousness and added a healthy dose of fun. There are 3,492 rules for properly drinking wine. David Wilson is on a mission to break all of them. Here's David.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang.
I could pore over that list of the top 100 wines from Wine Spectator for, gosh, days, I think. But we're going to shift gears here for a moment to a winemaking family that is doing something very interesting. And when I first heard about it, I didn't make the connection with an interview that I had done a couple of years ago. So when I put the pieces together, I was so excited. Well, let me set the story up by simply saying this. One of the most popular wines in America is a wine called The Prisoner. Everybody's got to get The Prisoner. Now, you may like it, you may not like it, it doesn't matter. But when you say Prisoner and wine, you think about this particular bottle of wine. Well, now we're going to change your thinking just a little bit, because when you think Prisoner and wine, you're now going to think about Barra of Mendocino. And we'll explain, actually, the better person to help me explain it is Martha Barra. And Martha, do you remember me coming out a couple of years ago and sitting in your living room and talking with Charlie?
I do, David. And I remember you're coming with your brother, Steve. And yes, Charlie told lots of stories to you.
He is just so interesting. And he's really a legend in the Mendocino County area. Well, in the wine business.
David, he's outlasted all of his, what I call cronies, you know, the ones who got him started in this business, like Robert Mondavi or Louis Martini or the Foppianos. And, you know, he's just outlived these people, but he is an icon.
No, he definitely is. Now, for those who may not be listening in the area, Mendocino County is one of the counties that is clustered with Napa and Sonoma. But it's a very different world up there. I think it's a much more laid-back world up in Mendocino County. Also a county that's known for not just growing grapes, but growing herbs in a big way. But this prisoner story that pertains to you is not about a wine called Prisoner, or not about all the knockoffs of Prisoner, but it's about picking grapes using prison labor. Tell me about that.
That's true. And I'll tell you how this all started. A couple of years ago, we were really having trouble finding pickers for various reasons. But I was at our local market, and there was a group of guys and one gal sitting there, and it had a little sign that says, "We'll work." And I pulled my pickup around. I said, "Jump in. Let's go pick grapes." And they said to me, "No, that's not the kind of work we want to do. We want to trim buds." And so that meant trimming buds of marijuana.
Oh,
and they can sit on a white bucket and make $20 an hour. Whereas our pickers work out in the hot sun. Yes, they can make $30 an hour. But it was shorting our labor market because they harvest at the very same time that we harvest our grapes.
So
I told the sheriff about it, and he came to me in June of this year and said, "You know, I think I want to help you out." And he said, "I can put together a crew of 6 inmates." And he said, "We'll even furnish the workers' comp." Well, that sounded a little bit too good to me. However, we kept working on this, and it ended up that he furnished us with a van at the use of our drivers. We would go pick up the inmates at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they would come with a lunch packed in a very nice cooler, and we would bring them to the ranch, and we integrated them into our regular crew. Now, we pay by the pan, which is a 40-pound lug.
Yeah.
And at first, they were not making minimum wage because they'd never done this before. So we had to subsidize their wages. But we thought it was well worth the investment. David, I'll tell you, by the end of the season, they were making $19 to $20 an hour, and they were so proud of themselves.
Awesome. Now, you couldn't pay them in wine, obviously.
Obviously, we couldn't pay them in wine, and we could not let them take their knife home at night because they, of course, went back through security.
You gave them a knife?
To pick grapes with, yes.
Okay.
These were not hardened criminals.
All
These
right.
were guys who had done stupid things.
And picking grapes is not a stupid thing to do, by the way.
It's a very hard thing to do.
Well, you know, I became really interested in the whole grape picking labor issue because, as you're probably aware, the labor board has been really cracking down on vineyards who are using volunteer labor, which, you know, so many do because people want to go out there and just pick grapes. And so now you don't even have that at your disposal.
Or work in the tasting room. We can't do that anymore either.
Has that put some fear in you?
No, because we've never really used volunteers. The only time we've done volunteers is we have a luncheon for our wine club members, and they come and pick grapes just for the experience, and then we feed them lunch. So we've never done volunteer labor. Going back to these guys who worked for us, one of the requirements was that they have an ankle bracelet on. It's like a GPS.
Yeah.
And so they pay $11 a day for the privilege of having that bracelet on and then being out among the working force. But $11 a day I thought was pretty steep, but they were willing to do that. And then the sheriff's office never wondered where they were.
Well, it's a great idea. My guest is Martha Barra. She and her husband, Charlie, own Barra of Mendocino. I've been there. I've done that. These are great people. Martha, they call you the other Martha or the second Martha. What's that
You've
about?
You've heard that, huh, David?
Oh, I've heard that.
I do cook.
So we're talking about Martha Stewart.
Yes, I know. Yes,
so this is interesting because you have prison labor helping you pick your grapes, and Martha Stewart was not in prison at the time that she could have been one of your pickers. How good would that have been? To have Martha Stewart out there.
We would have worked her right into the crew right along with the rest of them.
You would have treated her exactly the same?
Of course. Of course.
Would you have shared recipes with her?
No, she would have shared hers with me.
So is this a sign of things to come in coming years and harvest? Will you try to get more prison labor out there? It's a great idea, and it's good for the prisoners, too. Talk about...
Well, we have a very innovative sheriff here. We have a bakery at the jail. In fact, the guys would come with beautiful cinnamon rolls in the morning for their break. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I'm going to figure out how to get in jail so I can have some of those cinnamon rolls. He also has a couple of women who work in an industry making beautiful pies. So he, you know, he will place these workers in an industry where they will have success after they get out of jail. And the object of this really was to allow these people to have some money when they are freed. And our local savings bank of Mendocino came in and set up bank accounts for each of them and then would come each week when we paid and would put their money into that account.
So how were these fellows to work with?
They were great.
They were.
Very respectful.
Yeah. Very appreciative, I imagine, of the opportunity to do this.
They really complained on the days that we were waiting for sugar, waiting for the bricks to come up.
All right.
Yep. So they did not like being back in incarceration.
Now, the sheriff there, is he Italian by chance?
He is not, but you'd think that he was.
Well, you know why I thought he was? Because the only other place that I've ever heard of that uses prison workers to harvest grapes is on the island of Gorgona, which is the last Italian penal colony, and they make some apparently amazing wines there, and the prisoners pick the wines. Did you know that?
Mm.
So I thought maybe he...
I did not know that. Thanks for the information.
I thought maybe he got a call from a relative who said, hey, you could score some big points there in Mendocino County by letting those prison workers pick grapes.
No, I just think it's his way of, as I say, getting some money into these guys' pocket and then building a skill and building also something on their resume. Some of them were very young and they didn't have anything on their resume. So,
yeah,
you know, as I say, they've just done something stupid that landed them in jail.
My guest is Martha Barra of Mendocino. I guess you're using prison labor, so at least not completely, but some. So they've gone from behind bars to behind Barra.
Well, that's very clever, David. Yeah, no, our other crew, we had a contract crew from Napa, and then, of course, we have our own crew that we keep.
Did you get calls by chance when this story came out from other winemakers and grape growers saying, hey, how do I get in on this? And do you think there's more to go around? There's got to be.
No, but the sheriff said he did.
He did?
Yes, he said he did. He said, but I will keep you first even next year because you were willing to step up and give these people a chance.
And as I understand it, they were pretty slow at first, and the other pickers picked circles around them. Are they up to speed now?
They were up to speed.
You're done with harvest now, right?
We are finished with harvest. Yes, we are. Finished 15 days ahead of time.
Yeah, harvest was a little early this year, but how did the drought end up affecting you? Did you get a decent crop?
If you will ask growers in the North Coast, Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino, they will tell you they were down 20 to 25%.
That's a lot.
We don't bemoan that fact because, David, we had such a big crop in 2012 and 13. 13 was really the big one. So, you know, we need to empty some of those tanks that are full of Chardonnay and get back into balance.
Well, anytime you want to empty a tank, I know. You can stretch a hose down here to our studio, and we'll take care of that for you, Martha.
Do you have a label, David?
Do I have a label?
Uh-huh.
I'm willing to get one. My wife and I are, by the way, opening up a tasting room this weekend. It's something I've wanted to do my whole life. I think we should be carrying the Barra of Mendocino wines here in the Paso Robles area.
Well, I think that would be wonderful. We can do that. Of course,
yeah.
We have a lot of competition with Paso.
Well, Mendocino and Paso are similar, I think, in the sense that they're both making some fabulous wines, but they're not getting the prices or going for the prices generally that the wines in Napa and Sonoma are going for. You know, and you'll see some different varietals as well, but I think Mendocino wines are just such a great value.
And, they really are for the quality.
And Mendocino.
And you must realize that approximately 75% of the grapes grown in Mendocino County go to either Sonoma or Napa.
Well, there you go.
Because we don't have any large wineries here. We have Fetzer, but they have a lot of their own, plus they buy a lot of bulk wine, too, from other areas. So, you know, we're pretty small little wineries up here.
So if I had to drink just one bottle of Barra of Mendocino wine to get a sense of the winery and especially the heritage of the wine, what would I be drinking?
May I give you, please, two?
Yeah, I guess so.
One would be our very, very rich Petite Syrah. That's a mouth-filling, but it's round in the mouth because we've aged it properly, so there are no sharp edges. Lots of times Petite Syrah can set your teeth on edge, but that's not true of this one. And the reason I say two is because we are really noted for our Pinot Noir. We think of Anderson Valley and Mendocino County as being the premier, but we're Redwood Valley, and Redwood Valley is about as far north in California as you want to grow grapes. Very cold at night, warm in the day, but very cool at night. We make about 22,000 cases. 10,000 cases of that is Pinot Noir.
Wow. Now, I want to go back to that Petit Sirah for a second, because I would say that at least every third show that I do, I go on record, I stick my neck out there, as a matter of fact, and I absolutely believe that Petit Sirah is going to have a huge resurgence in the coming years, and it's going to be one of the hottest wines out there. You know, every wine has its day, and I think Petit Sirah's day is almost upon us. We're starting to see a lot more of it, and what a great wine. Oh,
it is. It is. If it's made properly, it is delicious.
Absolutely. Well, Martha, what a pleasure to have you on Grape Encounters.
Thank you, David.
This is such a treat. I so enjoyed just sitting in your living room and talking to Charlie. What's Charlie doing today?
We're going to go to the Coast House today. So after harvest, we thought we would go over there for a couple of days. And he's on his recumbent bicycle. So he's staying very healthy.
At what age is he riding a recumbent bicycle?
Well, he's 87 now, and he'll be 88 next month.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Amazing. All right. Well, you can search for the Bar of Wines. You could probably buy them online, I imagine, right?
Absolutely. So, barofmendocino.com.
Barra is B-A-R-R-A of Mendocino.com. I've had a number of their wines. Fantastic. Can't go wrong. And there's a huge amount of heritage in this family.
And David, we have another brand called Girasole Vineyards. Girasole. Very reasonably priced.
Okay.
So that's the one that you'll probably see in your area.
We will post a link to your website and resources, and we'll have some photographs there as well. So just if you can't remember any of this, just go to grapeencounters.com and check it out there. We've got the Grape Encounters news coming up next with our news correspondent, Larry Gifford. And again, Martha Barra, thanks so much for being on the show. I so appreciate
it. You're welcome,
sir. Love you guys up there.
You're having a Grape Encounter with David Wilson. What a way to spend the day. This is Grape Encounters News, a taste of what's happening in the world of wine.
Intro is not exactly correct because it says, I read the news today, oh boy, but we haven't done the news yet. It's time for the Grape Encounters news, and at the helm of the news broadcast, our one and only Larry Gifford, chief wine news correspondent. How you doing, Larry?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
I'm here to read the news.
All right. I know there's a lot in the news today, dive in. But you don't have to do the story about Wine Spectator's Top 100, but we already did that.
I know.
All right.
You're ahead of me.
Go for it.
There is a controversy bubbling up in Wine Enthusiasts' 2014 wine region of
the other big wine magazine.
Protests underway in upstate New York to stop the expansion of gas storage facilities that store fracked gas from Pennsylvania in old mined-out salt caves. The company, Crestwood Midstream Partners, plans to expand its current natural gas storage capacity by a third, from 1.5 billion cubic feet to 2 billion. Now, the peaceful activists are claiming...
What kind of gas is this? Like natural gas?
It's fracked gas.
Can't you use it for something?
Apparently not. So they're just putting it underground. And the peaceful activists are claiming that the gas caves, among other things, present an economic threat to the area's wine and tourism industries. They argue that the pressurized old salt caverns could cause salt and gas to seep into the lake and pollute the ground, which then endangers the grapevines and has a devastating effect on the region's wine industry. And there are reports that these gas storage facilities can and have exploded and killed people.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so that would be dangerous.
Can we join that protest? We'll go to New York and we'll carry placards, okay?
Okay,
I will, because this fracking thing is out of control.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. You know, I saw on the news recently, it has nothing to do with wine, a car that is powered by seawater.
Really?
Yeah, really. So let's be done with the fracking and let's start filling our tanks with, you know, would you like Pacific or Atlantic?
Eight California winemakers nearly had their liquor license suspended for 10 days over a tweet.
This is a ridiculous story.
It's actually a retweet. The message read, 2 days till at Save Mart Grape Escape in downtown hashtag Sacramento! ! Get tickets and info here with a link. And it was originally sent out by the Sacramento Convention and Visitors Bureau. But by naming the retailer in the tweet, all these winemakers violated the Tidehouse Law, which prevents producers from promoting retailers.
It's very strange. I would think almost nobody knows this, that you can't, as a winery, if you produce wine, you can't tell people where to get it.
Right. You can't.
So we've got wine, but you'll have to find it on your own, because if we tell you, we're going to lose our liquor license.
And so the ABC didn't hear about this. I mean, they're not monitoring tweets of small wineries.
Not yet.
But they didn't hear about it until competing companies flooded the agency with complaints.
Oh, no.
Yes. So all 8 wineries, including Revolution, Charles B. Mitchell Vineyards, and Wise Villa Winery, avoided their 10-day suspensions by accepting a year's probation as a penalty.
That means you're going to be watched like a hawk.
Yeah. That was a good hawk, David.
Yeah, you're going to be watched like a hawk.
There's a lot of laws.
There's a lot of laws, and they vary from state to state. It is really tough to get it right. Because there are just so many little nuances that you have to be so careful of.
Yeah.
All right.
How much would you pay for a virtually indestructible wine suitcase?
Well, that would depend on how much wine was in it and what kind of wine.
No, okay. It's empty, but you just get the suitcase. It's indestructible. You can put whatever wine you want in it.
I think that would be valuable.
$234?
It doesn't have wine in it for that
price.
No
wine.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. Okay. It sounds good. I'd like to see it.
It's called the Vanguard Valise. It's a rolling hard shell suitcase lined with high density temperature regulated foam that protects bottles while in transit.
So if the plane goes down, that suitcase will survive, and the black box will survive.
Yeah, more importantly, when the guys that are handling the luggage throw it haphazardly onto the plane, the bottles won't break.
But just think how handy it would have been if they had had suitcases like that filled with wine when Tom Hanks' plane went down on that deserted island.
Yes, that would have changed the movie entirely.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing, though.
He would have still been talking to the volleyball. It
well,
would just have
gonna, that's what I was going to say. Wilson would have drank most of it. All right, what else you got?
The restaurant chain Red Robin understands the growing appetite for wine in this country.
You know, I was just saying that at a party. I said, you know, nobody understands wine like Red Robin Restaurant.
So you know what they've done, David?
I haven't got a clue.
They've found a unique way to appeal to wine lovers, introducing the Divalicious Red Wine Shake. I'll say that again. The Divalicious Red Wine Shake.
Where do you get this stuff? Really? That was a press release from Red Robin?
Yeah, so this is a bold blend of Little Black Dress Divalicious Red Wine, vodka, raspberry puree, and vanilla soft serve ice cream topped with whipped cream and a drizzle of raspberry syrup.
Because you just can't get enough alcohol or calories in a wine, right?
Yeah, so one reviewer suggests, if an appletini isn't sweet enough for you, this is right up your alley.
And and don't worry about the fat, cholesterol, or anything like that.
That's
you know what? Actually, there are a number of ice cream and wine-based products coming out now.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Dairy and wine haven't really been friends traditionally.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Why?
It's the Kobe beef. You know, they feed liquor to those cows and then they slaughter them.
Really?
Yes.
No.
Up in Canada, they have a farm up there, and I don't know what the name of it is now because I know it's sold, but they were feeding every cow a liter of red wine per day.
And so
but the cows found out why they were being fed wine. They thought the cowboys just liked them. It turns out the beef tastes better when you feed them wine.
Oh, it's pre-marinated.
I actually got way off the topic, didn't I?
You did.
It's interesting, but true.
So it seems like everybody's coming up with their list of wines for Thanksgiving dinner. The New York Times and Forbes, local newspapers, wine experts, they're all out with their handy-dandy guides of what to drink with Thanksgiving dinner.
Mine's out.
David Wilson's is out.
I'm in
yours?
A Whisk magazine.
What is it?
It's a beautiful full-color magazine published by Melinda Lee, one of the great food broadcasters, actually. Just Google Whisk magazine. But I have a 4-page article on my Thanksgiving recommendations.
Well, let's just touch some of the highlights here. What wines would you pair with Thanksgiving, David?
Well, the problem with Thanksgiving is this. There are so many different flavors on the table, a conundrum of flavors.
That's not a problem. That's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure. So it gets a little bit tricky. So I kind of broke it down into the essentials, a little daring, and a category I call what the heck.
So what are the essentials?
Well, the essentials are to have on the table Pinot Noir,
okay,
Oregon Pinots, the Russian River Pinots from Northern California, Monterey Pinots, the Santa Rita Hills One of their Pinots just made it onto the top 10 list of Wine Spectator top 100.
Yeah.
Rieslings are great with Thanksgiving. They can be dry or a little bit sweet. I say Washington, the state of Washington, California, New York, or Germany.
Okay.
Okay. And then Zinfandels, but only California Zins.
Only California
Yeah,
Zins.
They're just right. And, you know, they've got that richness that pairs beautifully with cranberries. You know, they are almost cranberry-esque.
Cranberesque.
Cranberesque is the technical
term. Word.
Yes. And then also on the table and through the entire meal, champagne, sparkling wines, Prosecco from Italy, really good idea. Those are the essentials.
Okay. What the heck?
No. A little daring.
Oh.
Okay. This will be on my table. That would be Cabernet Sauvignon, Bordeaux blends.
Okay.
GSMs, you know, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre. And then Chardonnays or white Burgundy.
Oh.
Love white Burgundy. And then Merlot. Don't forget Merlot.
Merlot has been forgotten before.
Again, not Maryland Merlot.
Yeah.
And then finally, what the heck? This is the time that Beaujolais Nouveaux come out.
Right.
Really a great thing to put on your Thanksgiving table because it corresponds with the Thanksgiving holiday, you know? And then Petite Syrah, a big favorite. Gruner Veltliner from Austria, a good one. Gewürztraminer from Germany. And then maybe some rosés. I would say rosé of Cabernet or Merlot. Some Norton. You can get it from Missouri.
Okay.
And then finally, from Florida, they make cranberry wine.
No, they don't.
They do, too, for Thanksgiving. Anyway, I'll post this on the website.
Oh, please do.
And that's it. See you next week, Larry.
See you next week.
With about 5 extra pounds on.
I may waddle in here.
I'll look forward to that.